Hi, listeners, and welcome to the True Crime Weekly podcast, a podcast that is based in San Diego and hosted by me, Alina Trujillo, and my producer, Jose Fernandez. This is a podcast where I will be bringing you stories of murders, infamous cases, and unsolved mysteries. This week, I'm going to tell you about a serial killer couple that became convinced that some of their friends and frequent visitors that came to visit their pot farm were witches and were out to do harm to the world. So they decided to kill three people by smashing their skulls, stabbing, and shooting them. This couple often took hallucinogenic drugs, and during one of their trips, Susan had a vision to change their name from Susan to Suzanne and Michael Bear. This is the story of James Clifford Carson and Suzanne Barnes Carson. James, aka Michael, is described as a loving father and a very handsome man, but also a very damaged man. In 1977, James lived in Phoenix, Arizona with his then wife, Lynn Carson, and his daughter, Jen. Lynn was a teacher and James was a hippie, quote-unquote, stay-at-home dad that was occasionally dealt marijuana as well. But he was also very attentive to his young daughter. Jen described memories of his father, of him brushing her hair, reading her stories, and giving her breakfast every morning. Jen recalls having a very loving home until the last few months of her parents divorcing. Lynn started to notice that something was wrong with James when he started to become more and more violent with her in front of her daughter. Then one day, James pulled out a gun on her, and that's when Lynn knew she had to leave James. And in 1979, Lynn divorced James and left the house with their 5-year-old daughter, Jen. Susan was at the time also married and had a teenage son with her husband. Susan was known to be wealthy and she was very popular with her teenage son's friends. You know, sort of the cougar type. So Susan started to go out with her son's high school classmates, and it was said that she slept with 150 of her
150?
Son's, yes, of her son's classmates.
Are there even 150 classmates?
I have no idea. Wow. So along with these sexual encounters that she would have with these teenage boys, she also started to do drugs. She started dropping acid and smoking marijuana. But then Susan started to have visual hallucinations, which is a serious sign of mental illness like schizophrenia.
So it wasn't necessarily just the drugs. It was likely an actual mental
illness. Like an actual mental illness. Okay. Which, you know, schizophrenia and hallucinogenic drugs is the worst thing that a person can do. So along with the sex, the drugs, and her mental health deteriorating, Susan's husband divorced her. It doesn't take long for James and Susan to meet, though. They ended up meeting at a party, and from the very moment they met, they were inseparable. But the relationship wouldn't be a stable relationship.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah, because remember, so Lynn divorced James, or aka Michael, because she was already starting to notice some strange things with his mental health.
Okay,
so now we have the same situation going on with Susan. So Lynn and James still share custody of little Jen, which meant that Jen was to spend the weekends with her father and now stepmother Susan. Jen had described her father's house and Susan's house as the haunted forest in Snow White.
What does that even mean?
Well, I guess Jen has said that there was no furniture in the house and that the house was covered in potted plants.
Like marijuana plants?
Or? No, just like potted plants, all over.
It's like a greenhouse.
Right. So Jen said that her father wouldn't feed her anymore and that she even recalls having to climb up the cabinets looking for food because Susan and James would be passed out after a night long of dropping acid.
So sad.
I know, isn't it? Especially because she remembers before he divorced her mother, he was so attentive and he would always make her breakfast, brush her hair, read her stories. So now to do a complete 180, it was I'm sure, devastating for her. You know, she was very young, though, so I'm sure it was mostly just confusing to Jen.
I'm sure, like, it was. A lot of change and then completely different behavior from the dad.
Yeah.
It's been really, really difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And Jen did say that she recalls that there was, in the entire house, there was only one piece of furniture. You want to guess what that was?
Like a big, ugly chair.
No, it was a king-sized waterbed.
Of course it was a waterbed.
but that's the sad part. That's not even where, like, she would sleep. She would have to sleep on the floor in a sleeping bag, and Susan and Michael would be passed out in the waterbed. Naked.
Why?
Because I don't know, it's a waterbed. I don't know, you're dropping acid. You probably, I don't know. Floating in the ocean. Yes. So Jen said that she had tried to tell her mother, Lynn, what was going on, but she was too little to express, to even, you know, try to convey what was happening during these sleepovers to her mom. Until one day, Jen told Lynn how Susan had scratched her back. And when Lynn looked at Jen's back, she saw 5 scratches going down her daughter's back.
Really?
Yeah. And from that point on, Lynn told Jen that she wouldn't be going back to that house. And for months, Lynn went into hiding from her estranged husband, James, and his now wife, Susan. So Lynn was just terrified of James and the violent behavior that he was now starting to show, that she was terrified that he would eventually find her and Jen and harm them.
So at that point, he hadn't really done anything like that, right? I'm assuming...
No, he had became very violent. That's why she had divorced him.
Okay, see.
So Lynn feared that James would take, that he could even take their daughter away and, or even kill them both. Because remember, she divorced him after he pulled out a gun. She was like, I've had enough. So Lynn and Jen would constantly stay at different family houses to kind of throw him off.
Mm-hmm.
And they would stay at, like, family houses. They would stay at family friends' houses. They were pretty much couch surfing from house to house so that James wouldn't find them. Which, you know, as a little girl, that must have been very, very hard and, you know, kind of unstable, too.
Just complete,
you know,
instability, right? Yeah.
Probably just, I don't know. I mean, it's a shame that, yeah, it became such this big fear for them, you know?
Right.
So, on March 7th, 1981, the body of aspiring actress, 23-year-old Karen Barnes, was found in her apartment. Karen was one of the first victims of Suzanne and Michael. Karen was living in San Francisco and shared an apartment with Michael and Suzanne. So, Michael and Suzanne, and I keep on saying Suzanne, by the way, because her name is Susan, so S-U-S-A-N, but remember in that vision while she was on her trip,
mm-hmm.
It was like, no, I'm Suzanne with a Z. Anyway.
Big difference.
Right.
Suzanne.
Yeah. So anyways, so Suzanne and Michael had taken a trip to Arizona, and when the couple returned back home, Suzanne happened to receive a message from God during a thunderstorm stating that she needed to kill Karen. Michael and Suzanne arrived at the apartment that they shared with Karen, and they waited for her to come home. And this is what I read from the court document, how supposedly that night took place, okay?
Oh, okay.
So Michael said that when Karen came home, she stayed in the front room for several hours, and then she passed Suzanne and Michael's room without speaking to go into the kitchen. And the court document stated that Michael said that he stayed in the bathroom praying for strength. Then, as he prepared to enter the kitchen, Michael said that Suzanne gave him a knowing look, quote unquote. You know, kind of like that look you give your best friend when, like, somebody you don't like walks in, like,
Look
at that bitch. That's my friend. Anyway.
Just like that, huh?
So, giving him that knowing look, indicating that she would distract Karen. Suzanne asked if it was time to make tea. The comment distracts Karen, and Michael turned the faucet, like,
yeah,
turns it up all the way.
Sure.
Okay? He turns the faucet all the way to cover up any noise and to also distract Karen. Then Michael said that he hit Karen on the head with a cast iron pot. Then as Karen is laying in the kitchen floor, Michael said that he stabbed her twice on the neck with a paring knife.
Oh man.
So now Michael said he only stabbed her twice. But when Karen's body was found, she was stabbed 13 times.
Well, how did that happen then?
Oh, Michael has a very good explanation for that. Michael said that it must have been the landlord that stabbed her after he had stabbed her twice.
The landlord? Where did he come from?
Yeah, you know, he came in and found the body, must have found the body, and then stabbed her.
Yeah, because that's what people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in court, Michael said that he killed Karen in defense of Susan because he said that Karen was a witch and that Karen was draining Suzanne of physical beauty and her powers as a perfect yogi.
How do we know what to say to that?
Well, you have to see a picture of her, too, so you can see her beauty.
Maybe it was drained by all the acid and drugs that she was taking.
So after Michael and Susan kill Karen, they flee from San Francisco and head to Oregon to hide in a mountain shack that they heard about. Now where? I don't know, but they somehow heard about some shack in the mountains and they head over there.
Sounds really creepy.
Right. So
these two people are in a mountain shack somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Boy. After killing Karen, Michael and Susan start to call themselves Muslim assassins, preparing a jihad against witches and evildoers.
Where did that even come from?
Well, they just made up their own religion and their own beliefs.
Okay.
Because according to them, they took the Muslim religion, but then they also like took their own other beliefs. Like they took, I guess they were vegetarians, but they ate mostly fruit. And then combined with yoga.
And acid.
But they call themselves that they followed the Muslim religion, but it was not Muslim at all. It was not any of the Muslims' beliefs or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But according to them, it was.
Yeah.
So again, remember, Michael and Suzanne right now are currently hiding in a mountain shack, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But they end up getting kicked out of the little shack by a ranger. So they start to head south to California. And on May 22nd, 1981, they hitchhike a ride from a man who lets them stay at a treehouse that he owns at the Ventana Wilderness.
How do they even find a guy that owns a treehouse?
Right?
What is this?
I know. So the man ends up kicking out Michael and Suzanne just a few days after he let them stay there. But Suzanne tells Michael that he needs to confront the man because he can't just throw them out of a place like this.
What did she expect?
I mean, they don't even own it. It's a, you know. But anyway.
Suzanne.
Yeah. So Michael and Suzanne end up robbing the guy's house. And Suzanne finds a gun in the house and she tells Michael that the gun is a reward for earning his wings, quote unquote.
Oh my gosh.
She tells him that Allah wanted him to have the gun. And Michael takes the gun and he torches the man's house. And they flee once again.
They are crazy.
What gave you that idea?
It just took, a few minutes to get to that.
Was it the witches? So then after they torch the man's house, they leave and head to Humboldt County, California. And in May of 1982, Michael and Suzanne get jobs at a rural marijuana plantation. And while working in the marijuana plantation, Michael makes an instant enemy.
Oh, of course, not an instant friend. God forbid.
No. There's an instant enemy. Clark Stevens. During an argument between Michael and Clark, it was said that Clark started to use foul language and started calling Suzanne names. And Suzanne then orders Michael to defend her and take care of Clark. So, because in their Muslim, quote unquote, their Muslim religion, mm-hmm. says that if anybody insults her as a woman, it's the same as somebody raping her.
Oh.
So she looks at Michael and tells him, you know what to do. Take care of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
This guy's just following along.
So on May 17th, 1982, Humboldt County police officers get a 911 call from one of the farmers from the marijuana plantation. And they told police that they had seen their dog playing with a ball.
Only, oh, man. What was the ball?
Yeah, only it wasn't a ball, Jose. It was a human skull.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And I just, side note, I just mm-hmm. have to say, you know it's bad when drug dealers or somebody, you know, marijuana plantation that owns it is like calling the police. It's like, hey, you might want to get up here. Like, we didn't do this.
This wasn't me.
This was not us.
Don't look over here.
Ignore the whole plantation of marijuana.
Like, I mean, this was the 80s. I don't know how that worked out back
then. Yeah, that's true. I don't know.
If it was, I'm assuming it was illegal, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, it barely became legal. So police go to the marijuana plantation to investigate, and they find the body of Clark Stevens, which it seemed like his body had been drenched in lighter fluid and then burnt. But it seemed like when the body didn't burn properly, they had also poured chicken manure on the body to try and hide the smell.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as police are looking around, mm-hmm. they end up finding a wallet with an ID. And that's when they find that the body belonged to Clark Stevens. And during the autopsy report, that's when they also find that Clark was not only burnt, but he was shot.
I wonder what happened.
So it seems like Michael and Suzanne shot him, mm-hmm. then drenched his body in lighter fluid. Light him on fire, and then I guess maybe the fire wasn't getting hot enough, and the body didn't burn. So, because obviously they had chicken manure, I'm assuming for the marijuana plants, mm-hmm. that they just decided, oh, let's just cover so the body won't smell. Let's just throw a bunch of chicken manure on top of the body, and hopefully nobody will find it. So, after killing Clark Stevens, once again, Michael and Suzanne leave town and they head over to Trinity County, California. Then the following day, after arriving at Trinity County, Michael and Suzanne get scared after they encounter a sheriff's officer looking for a lost hitchhiker. And thinking that they were looking for them, they like drop what they had, like their backpacks and everything, and they take off running. And yeah,
it sounds like a bad movie.
Right. They take off running, and they're in their minds, like the cop is right there behind them, like they're hot on their trail. Mm-hmm. So Michael ends up heading over to Los Angeles, and Suzanne heads deeper into the forest. But they didn't even know that the cop was just like, what?
What just happened?
Yeah, like,
what, these two weirdos
chasing them.
That's crazy.
Officers start to look through the backpacks that they had dropped when they took off running. And they find marijuana. They find bullets. And they find an ID with the name Richard Arata. So along with the ID, they also find a manuscript called A Cry for War. The manuscript has a hit list with names like Ronald Reagan and Johnny Carson. Police officers also find that the manuscript has the name of the author. And that name was that of Michael Bear.
Michael Bear.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So it seemed that Michael and Suzanne wanted to kill Ronald Reagan and Johnny Carson. You're never going to believe why.
Why?
Because their first, middle, and last names had six letters, meaning
witches
everywhere. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad we have somebody fighting those witches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. True statement. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Oh, wait, vampire. Not witches.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
So police find that the ID found in the backpack had been actually stolen a few months back. And when they run the name Michael Bear, they find that Michael is wanted for questioning in the murder of Clark Stevens. They are also able to lift fingerprints from the manuscripts and they enter them into the narcotics database. And because the manuscript had names of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, along with other government officials, the Secret Service immediately picks this up. Okay, so while all this is going on, they're running the fingerprints, they're running the name on the ID. Now remember, all this happened because a police officer approached them. They thought, oh my God, they drop everything, they take off running. Yeah. One goes...
Abort.
Yeah, one goes deeper into the forest, the other one takes off to Los Angeles, okay? So, when Michael makes his way to Los Angeles, he gets picked up by police officers. But he gets picked up because he matched a raped suspect that they happen to be looking for. So he's walking along the streets of Los Angeles and then a cop pulls up and they're like, wait a minute, that looks like a rape suspect that we're looking for. Pulls him over. Michael gets arrested. But when he gets put into the back seat of the police car, he's able to hide the gun that he was carrying in the back seat. So
he got arrested with a gun?
With the gun, but they didn't notice it. The police officers didn't notice it. So they arrested him, but I guess it was said because the gun was like so far deep into his underwear that they just missed it.
He couldn't reach it or whatever.
They missed it, they didn't even feel it on him. But somehow he was able to, while he's in the police car with his hands behind his back because he's under arrest, he's able to pull out the gun from his underwear and he like tucks it in between like the cracks of like the seating.
No, they're gonna see the crack of something else. Deep into his underwear.
No. Like he like stuffs it in there.
Okay.
Okay. While being questioned, Michael gives them, you know, the fake name of Richard Arata. But police officers fail to check the narcotics database. So they end up taking a picture of him and faxing it to the hospital where the rape victim was at. And when the victim says, that's not the person that raped me, police officers let Michael go.
Just like that,
huh? They had him. So after police officers let him go, the next day, the other police officer is checking the squad car before he goes out on patrol. And when he checks the back seat, guess what he finds?
The gun that's in his...
Right, the gun. So after the gun is found, police officers put out a APB, which is all points bulletin, meaning they're looking for this person, okay?
Yeah, got it.
But they put out the APB using the fake name that Michael had given them
Richard Arata. Oh, no.
So authorities in Humboldt County identified the name of Richard Arata, and they give them the name of Michael Bear. So now authorities have the gun. And they also have the mugshot, because remember, when they brought Michael in because they thought that he was the person that raped somebody else,
right,
they had taken that picture, faxed it over to the rape victim. The rape victim was like, no, that's not him. So with the gun, authorities go back to the marijuana farmer that had reported that skull that the dog was playing with.
Yeah.
And the marijuana farmer tells them that mugshot belongs to Michael.
That's Michael.
That's Michael.
He confirmed it.
Right. So police officers send the gun to ballistics and they're able to make the match that the gun is the same gun that shot Clark Stevens.
Really? Good. We're getting closer.
So Michael and Suzanne end up meeting again and they end up in Portland with some friends. But just like how everybody else, and you know, apparently these people are not well liked because the friends end up kicking them out right away. But before they get kicked out, Michael ends up stealing a gun from their house before they leave.
Yeah, because he lost his other gun
right
in the crack of the seat.
So the couple starts to hitchhike again, and when they do, they spot a truck that ends up stopping for them. And when the truck stops to pick them up, Susan tells Michael that the person in the car is a witch.
How does she know so quickly?
She's psychic. Oh, did I not mention that
earlier? I missed that part.
Oh, she's psychic. No, she was like this very powerful psychic.
Prophetic. Right. She hears God. And
right.
Psychic, mm-hmm. can see the future.
Yeah. So she tells Michael that this guy is the witch and they're going to have to kill him. So while in the truck, according to Suzanne, the man's leg touched Suzanne's leg. So she looks over at Michael and she gives him, you know, that look. And she leans forward, and when she does, Michael pulls out the gun, and the man and Michael begin to struggle. The man pulls the car over, and he jumps out of the car, but Michael and Suzanne do too. Michael ends up shooting John Hellyer in the middle of the road with cars driving by. So they didn't care. It's a witch, and it has to die.
It's gotta go.
He's gotta go. So immediately, Suzanne jumps into the driver's seat. Obviously, Michael jumps in as well. And they start to drive away. They start to drive north from Sonoma County to Napa Valley. And a driver that had witnessed the shooting, obviously, like, calls 911.
Right.
Reported it. And there's a high-speed chase between two counties. And just over the Napa County line, Suzanne loses control of the truck and crashes into a ditch.
No.
Yeah. So Michael,
finally can get her.
So Michael and Suzanne jump out of the truck and they run into the woods. But this time, police officers end up catching up to them and arresting them.
Oh, good.
Right? So during the pretrial hearing in Santa Rosa, Michael confesses to killing John Hellyer and Clark Steven. But Suzanne refuses to speak while in court.
Really?
Yeah.
She just sits there.
Yeah. And I saw this documentary. They showed Suzanne's lawyer. Uh-huh. And he was like baffled. He was like, I had never seen that before in my life. A person that's capable of speaking and like sit nothing, like sitting there, not saying a word, just letting Michael speak for both of them.
So weird.
Yeah.
Well, she has powers.
Oh, that's right.
Whatever she had to say.
But you know what? Make. She couldn't have been that good of a sidekick because did you not see this coming? Hello.
Just never know. Sometimes things just go bad.
Yeah. So Michael and Suzanne are upset that they're not getting the proper publicity since they're in a small town.
Publicity?
Of Santa, yeah.
That's what they're concerned about?
Yeah, because they're in this small town of Santa Rosa. But that is until a San Francisco newspaper picks up Michael's story, and in hopes that this will get them publicity, Michael admits to a killing in San Francisco. So when San Francisco police detectives go to question Michael and Susan, they agree to confess to the murder of Karen Barnes, but they will only do it during a press conference. So they want everybody there. They want the attention. That's the only way that they'll confess to this.
I'm kidding. That is ridiculous.
Because in their head, they're doing the world a favor.
So they want the world to know?
Rid of witches. Till today, there's still no remorse because in their minds, they're doing the world a favor. Ridding the world of all these witches. Michael and Susan wanted to get rewarded for the killing of Karen Barnes.
Who was going to be rewarding them for that?
The world. Like, they expected the world to just be so thankful because, again, they're getting rid of witches. According to Michael and Susan, Karen was one of the most powerful witches in San Francisco. So reward us. Thank us. You're welcome, San Francisco.
My God, it's crazy.
Yeah. So when cameras come on, Michael begins to talk for 6 hours.
I think you're going
to
say 6 minutes.
No, for 6 hours about their religious beliefs. And again, this is like, it's not even a religion. This is a religion they made up. They claim it's a Muslim, but it's not the Muslim religion.
Right. It's their own made up thing.
Yeah. So, Jose, you want to hear a quick clip?
Yes. You have something?
Yes. Just to hear what Michael sounds like.
I'd love to.
Okay.
Evil doesn't create. Good is creative and evil is like a parasite or a leech that it can't create, that it can only copy. That's why powerful evil people are always attracted to Suzanne.
So I know that his voice is kind of hard to understand because it's almost like he has a little kid's voice.
Yeah, it didn't sound anything like what I expected. Yeah, at all.
Right? But he said, you know, evil is a leech. Evil cannot create. They can only copy. This is why horrible evil is always attracted to Suzanne. Because she's
so
powerful.
No wonder. No wonder.
His voice is just so crazy. Like, it's just not what you would think that, you know, he would sound like. He definitely has that very childish voice. Like, if you're just listening to it, you don't think that's an adult man talking.
No. And he's, like, doing his little sermon. And then, mm-hmm. because I saw a video, you see Suzanne.
And you see her looking just smiling at her just, and just, yeah. It's just
like, yes, mm-hmm. thank you for spreading the word here.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
On October 23rd, 1983, a psychiatrist ruled the couple fit to sit trial for the murder of Karen Barnes.
Yeah, they're not crazy.
No. So. And on July 2nd, 1984, they are convicted of the murder of Karen Barnes and sentenced to 25 years to life. Then in 1985, they received the same sentence for the murder of Clark Stevens. Then, in 1987, they receive the same sentence for John Hellyer, and the couple would not be eligible for parole until 2038, at the age of 87 and 96.
Still too soon.
Well, in an effort to declutter the many prisons of California, new legislation passed to allow inmates over 60 years of age an early parole.
Over 60?
Over 60. At this time, Michael and Suzanne had been in prison for over 30 years and were not expecting parole. In 2015, Michael at the time was 64 and he refused to begin the parole process because he remained stern in his belief that he had done no wrong by ridding the world of witches. And because of the elder parole program for inmates who are older than 60
right.
and have spent more than 25 years in jail, on May 27th, 2020, Michael Bear Carson, now 69 years old, had a parole hearing from Mule Creek State Prison, where he is serving 3 25 to life sentences. The hearing was watched on Zoom by family members of the victims because obviously they couldn't attend due to COVID-19.
Right.
And Jen, so Michael's daughter.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Was there to talk about her father and to oppose his release.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So she said, if given the opportunity, my father will kill again.
Yeah, you don't hear him? He's still over here giving his sermon to whoever
will hear. And she says that neither one of them has showed any remorse. She has gone to the prison, talked to her father before all this, and she says that he shows zero remorse. So, Michael did not get parole. And it will be another 10 years before he will be up for parole again. And Jen said that she will keep on attending each parole hearing to ensure that both him and Susan stay behind bars.
Good.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw this documentary where Jen said a statement that really hit home because I think that a lot of people don't understand that for serial killers, for murderers out there, obviously the victims are those who they harmed.
Right.
But also Jen gave a quote. She said, people don't think about the relatives of the violent offender, but the relatives of the violent offenders are also victims.
That's true. That is very true.
I was reading her story and I was watching documentaries on her, and it's just so sad because she said for a long time how she was depressed. She tried to commit suicide at the age of 10 years old.
10?
10 years old.
So young.
I mean, it's true. Like, she's a victim too, you know, even though that is her father. And not only that, she's not blind to it. She sees the evil in her father. You know, that's why she goes and she speaks up for these victims. And she says, that's my father. And he will kill again. So that, to me, I think is such a powerful statement for her as the daughter of a serial killer to go out there and advocate for these victims.
Yeah, that's definitely a strong statement. And I'm sure as she's advocating, that's a strong statement too. The decision-making process for the parole.
Mm-hmm.
So very good.
And this week, San Diego County Crime Stoppers and investigators from the San Diego Police Department Homicide Unit are continuing to ask for the public's help in identifying and locating the suspect or suspects responsible for the murder of 31-year-old Armando Torres Jr. On May 29, 2019, at 9:34 p.m., the San Diego Police Communication Center received multiple 911 calls regarding a shooting occurring during a soccer game being played at the Willie Henderson Sports Complex located at 1035 South 45th Street. When officers arrive at the park, they discover Armando Torres Jr. suffering from traumatic gunshot wounds to the upper body. Officers began CPR until they were relieved by the San Diego Fire Rescue personnel. Torres was pronounced deceased at the scene minutes later. And I actually have a clip from Armando Torres Sr. asking for the public's help.
For the public to help us on that night. There was a soccer game going on. There's a lot of people, you know, who would like you people to let us know if you saw anything, you know, to call and help us out and help my granddaughter, because this is all we have left. Ashes. We will never be able to hug him. She will never be able to hug her dad. We're asking for your help. To call Crime Stoppers, you will be anonymous.
His son was found. He got shot during a soccer game at the park. And it's been 1 year since his murder has been unsolved. So we're asking for anyone that has any information on this murder to please call San Diego Police Department or please contact San Diego Crime Stoppers Anonymous Tip Line. As we always like to say, if you contact Crime Stoppers, you will remain anonymous. And let's try and bring justice for this family. Armando Torres Jr. had a little girl. And just like his father said, his little girl will never get to hold him again. He will never get to hug his son again. Let's help and bring justice to this family. If you want to look at pictures and want more information on the cases we cover, you can head over to truecrimeweeklypodcast.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at podcasttruecrimeweekly. And I would truly love it and appreciate it if you would leave a 5-star review and subscribe onto Apple Podcasts. The only way that people find out about us is through subscribers and reviews. Thanks for listening.